I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Supply of COVID-19 vaccines has finally outpaced demand. Is the pandemic almost over? How will we know when it's ended? Will there be a grand declaration along the lines of mission accomplished, or will we just gradually stop wearing masks, keeping our distance, and talking about it? What insight can past pandemics offer as to what the future holds? The medical historians Dr. Jeremy Green and Dr. Graham Mooney of Johns Hopkins Medicine join me. They've studied pandemics, past and present, as well as the history of vaccine hesitancy. Plus, remembering our friend and colleague, C. Fraser Smith, WIPR's former senior news analyst, with SUNY Khalid and Joel McCord. They reflect on Fraser's life and legacy. First, the news. And good afternoon. Welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're with us. Thanks. Optimism is in the air. Yesterday, the CDC issued new guidance about mask wearing outside and other perks for people who have been fully vaccinated against the coronavirus. The Baltimore City Health Department is reviewing the CDC guidance, and they may adjust their mask ordinance. But most experts say that unless you're in a crowd of strangers, if you've had a vaccine, you don't need a mask outside. Supply of the vaccine has finally caught up with demand. The challenge facing us now is no longer finding enough vaccine, it's finding enough people who want to take it. If enough of us do take it, herd immunity will be achieved and we will be back to normal, or at least so the theory goes. So how will we know when the pandemic is really and truly over? When do pandemics end? My first guests today are two medical historians from Johns Hopkins who have studied the COVID-19 pandemic in the context of other viruses like the 1918 flu, polio, smallpox, and HIV/AIDS. Dr. Graham Mooney and Dr. Jeremy Green join us on Zoom. Dr. Mooney, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And Dr. Green, welcome to you as well.
Thanks, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
And listeners, if you'd like to join our conversations with Drs. Mooney and Green, we are at 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wipr.org, and you can tweet us at @MiddayWIPR. So Dr. Green, let me start with you with a broad question. How do pandemics end? At what point do we declare them over?
So this is such an important question, Tom, and it's, we've seen more than a year of predictive reports of how this pandemic will end. You know, their initial claims to roadmaps for the end of the pandemic started showing up in March of 2020. Few of them actually, the events that we've lived through really do not really conform to any of those predictions. And I think here's where, as historians, we first of all claim no status as futurologists, and also begin to realize that historians of medicine and historians in general have focused on epidemics in history really for generations, but we know a lot more about how epidemics begin. Like, we can oftentimes point to the first index cases, how and where they spread, how the alarm began, at what point broader regulatory, international, and and broader social interventions were brought to bear. But we have got a bit of a blind spot in terms of looking at how they end. Or we might ask how they end for whom, where they end, and where they don't end, and where we learn simply to not pay attention to them anymore. And so one definition of how epidemics end is this classic epidemiological modeling curve. And, I'd say in the last year, the general population has become much more familiar with looking at these curves of how we bend and flatten the curve, how we think about who is susceptible, who is infected, and who has recovered from an infectious threat. These are sort of the predictive bases of infectious disease epidemiology. And this other figure called R0, the reproductive number, which is different for any given infectious threat. And there's a simple calculation that, the epidemic begins to end in this mathematical frame when the proportion of susceptible people in a population drop below the number 1 over R0. And that's this herd immunity that you're referencing. And yet that apparent simplicity of you know, that mathematical formula, the ability to think predictively, really doesn't conform with the rather jagged experiences that we've actually been having over the last year. And another answer to that question is that an epidemic ends when the population affected stops paying attention to it or is able to look past it towards some form of new normal.
Yeah, and Dr. Moody, is it possible for a pandemic, which means it's a global phenomenon, to end in some places and not in other places? I mean, much of the United States is experiencing a pretty good down tick in cases, deaths, hospitalizations, etc. And then you've got places like India, which enjoyed, you know, a pretty good run for a good bit of the beginning months of the pandemic. And by some estimates, they're having 2 million cases, new cases of COVID every day. And their hospital system is overwhelmed. There's a shortage of oxygen. They can barely keep up with disposing and you know, well, keeping track of the dead bodies in India. I mean, it's just, it's a terrible situation. So will someone come out and say the United States no longer has an epidemic of COVID-19, even though it may still be raging through places like India?
Well, that's certainly possible. And you know, you'd expect the CDC to be the agency to make that proclamation. But I think it's dangerous to do that because, as we've seen, you know, we're interconnected and we're interconnected more than ever before. But even historically, you know, the connections between different parts of the world were so fluid and so rapid that you could get diseases like cholera and smallpox, even bubonic plague, making their way across the globe at a fairly rapid pace. So it's very dangerous to say that an epidemic has ended in one place and it continues in another, because I think what that does, it kind of dismisses our shared global experience of this. And one valuable thing it might do to declare the epidemic or the pandemic coming to a close in places like the United States and other Western countries is that, okay, well, we can, you know, we can turn our attention to providing resources for other nations. But that in itself is problematic because we should be doing that already. We should already be recognizing that there's a, you know, we have a shared common humanity here in order to respond to pandemics. And so it shouldn't be, you know, an international race to the top or the bottom of a kind of sort of like vaccine and end of pandemic nationalism that is actually not particularly productive.
Dr. Graham Moody is an associate professor in the history of medicine and epidemiology at Johns Hopkins. Dr. Jeremy Green is the director of the Center for Medical Humanities and Social Medicine, as well as a scholar at the Center for Innovative Medicine. We're talking about how we'll know when the pandemic is over. 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle is @MiddayWIPR. So Dr. Green, you gave a podcast for your colleagues at Hopkins a couple of weeks ago, I guess. And I was surprised to hear in that podcast that only a few epidemics in human history have actually been eradicated through intentional means. So this vaccine that we have, it would be extraordinary if, in fact, we can pretty much eliminate coronavirus by, you know, having the majority of the population of the world take this vaccine. That would be an unusual circumstance, I guess. Is that right?
Yeah, and I think here it's important to think about the difference between control and eradication. And so there are a number of outbreaks, you know, that have been controlled, and even in the 21st century alone, let alone the 20th and you know, broader human history. But the intentional eradication of human disease, this long goal over this this heroic concept of, especially in the 20th century, that we were, you know, through biomedical science and public health, really rolling back and turning the tide on infectious disease. Only a few infectious diseases have actually been eradicated, you know, smallpox being really the chief example. And so I think that even when we think about diseases that were effectively controlled through vaccination efforts, and I think polio is an excellent example here, we've seen a lot of, you know, reminiscences of, you know, Jonas Salk's and, you know, Sabin's work on polio vaccinations in the mid-20th century as we've been rolling out the COVID-19 vaccine in the past 6 months. But even polio, which many people in the United States, many NPR listeners might think of as a historical epidemic, right, still is having outbreaks in different parts of the world. So when we talk about even successful control of an epidemic disease using a vaccine that has been developed specifically for that and with a heroic narrative, there's still a question of, well, for whom has that epidemic ended and where and when? And even here in the United States, when we think of polio as a historical epidemic, there are still people living with lingering disabilities from the polio that they've experienced for whom that epidemic has not necessarily ever really ended either. So we have to be really careful when we think about epidemic endings that it often assumes a mainstream we that only tells really part of the story.
And Dr. Mooney, in 1918, there was another influenza outbreak around the world. At what point historically is there a point in which people said, okay, the 1918 pandemic is over? I mean, did it just sort of gradually fade in people's imaginations?
That's a very interesting question, Tom, because the 1918-19 global influenza pandemic was very much enmeshed with the events of the First World War. And so there's a kind of, yeah, there's an ending narrative there around both the pandemic and the First World War, a sort of closure and then an opening up of the 1920s. So the answer to that is kind of yes. And there was a lot of, you know, one of the things that happened in the 1990s and the early 2000s is historians sort of rediscovered influenza, the 1918-19 pandemic influenza, in a big way, because lots of people, you know, the feeling being that, you know, lots of people had not wanted to refer back to it and talk about it because of the, you know, the association with the First World War and the suppression of the memory of the pandemic. So there's been a lot of work historically about, you know, the patterns of the influenza pandemic, the memories of it, and so on. And this is one of the other ways in which I think we can say a pandemic never ends. We've been talking constantly as historians about the 1918-19 influenza pandemic. It hasn't finished for us because we're still writing about it, we're still thinking about it, and it's actually informed greatly the response to, for good or ill, the response to COVID-19. So I would say that in that respect, pandemics, epidemics, infectious disease never end, even if epidemiologically they're eradicated.
And Dr. Green, in the case of HIV/AIDS, I mean, you mentioned polio and how polio has not actually been, you know, completely eradicated off the face of the earth. There's no cure, I guess, for HIV/AIDS. There are ways of controlling the disease. There are ways of perhaps even preventing the disease, prophylactic medications that people can take. But at some point, people just sort of stopped talking about HIV/AIDS, other than the medical professionals and the people who had the disease, who obviously kept attending to it. What parallels do you draw between that example and the example of the coronavirus, and what might happen with our approach to that moving forward?
Thanks for that question, Tom. And, you know, there's a line from Mark Twain that I'm reminded of regularly, which is that, you know, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes, which is to say all of these different prior experiences of epidemic and pandemic disease capture some important reflections of the present pandemic, but all have important differences as well. And I think one important thing to be gleaned from comparing COVID-19 pandemic with the HIV/AIDS pandemic is to remember that in the early years of HIV/AIDS, it was treated much the same way as in the early years of COVID-19, this threatening, emerging new disease that was spreading quickly with devastating consequences and with a lot of uncertainty around cause, etiology, its ability to spread, how to treat and how to prevent and who it affected. And so AIDS was very much described as an epidemic and a pandemic. And yet we have reached a point, you know, in the year, 2021, where you can find some places in which HIV/AIDS is described as an epidemic disease. And yet there is an overall management of it, an approach which shifts more towards the endemic, that HIV/AIDS is understood simply to be part of life as we know it, a chronic manageable disease that affects some people more than others, to which there are different preventive and therapeutic regimens with still continued disparities in terms of who actually gets infected, who doesn't, and who has access to treatment and who doesn't. And yet, from a strictly biological perspective, the AIDS epidemic has never ended, right? The virus spreads devastation through the world. There's 1.7 million people a year being infected, estimated 770,000 deaths in the year 2018 alone. But it's not generally described with the same urgency and fear as it was in the early 80s. And I would say it's not simply now. If you look at the history of how much effort AIDS activists had to put on pressure on the mainstream press, on the American government, remember Ronald Reagan famously would not address AIDS by name as a public health crisis. And then on international modes of governance, so that, in other words, the popular gaze kept on drifting away from HIV and AIDS. And it's only because people with AIDS and AIDS activists continue to push it back and demand attention that it actually got the sustained attention it did. That left to itself, an epidemic that kills many, many people can still drift out of view of the popular press and the popular. Yeah,
and of course, there's a guy named Tony Fauci who was right in the middle of that situation as well. I mean, it's amazing to think that if we get to the point where, you know, there's 1.5 million cases of coronavirus and 800,000 deaths every year, we'll consider it over. I mean, that's really just, if there's any parallel there, that's just wild. Dr. Jeremy Green is the director of the Center for Medical Humanities and Social Medicine and a scholar at the Center for Innovative Medicine at Johns Hopkins. Dr. Graham Mooney is an associate professor in the history of medicine and epidemiology. We'll have more with Drs. Green and Mooney on the other side of a quick break. To join our conversation, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us @MiddayWYPR. You can tweet me @TomHallWYPR. Stay with us.
You're listening to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
Good afternoon and welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, analysis of the speech that President Biden is giving before a joint session of Congress tonight. We'll have NPR's complete coverage of the speech tonight at 9 o'clock. And tomorrow, I'll talk about it with Pierre Thomas, the justice correspondent for ABC News. And I'll also speak with Ian Millhiser. He's a senior correspondent at Vox. He's got a new book out called The Agenda: How a Republican Supreme Court is Reshaping America. And coming up later in our show today, remembering Fraser Smith, the newspaper man and broadcaster who is part of the WYPR family for more than a decade and who is part of the Baltimore region for more than 30 years. SUNY Collett and Joel McCord will join me to share their reflections about Fraser, who passed away Sunday at the age of 83. And now back to our conversation about the history of pandemics with two medical historians from Johns Hopkins Medicine. Dr. Graham Mooney and Dr. Jeremy Green join us on Zoom. You are welcome to join us as well. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And Dr. Mooney, my apologies. Evidently, I mispronounced your name a couple of times in the first segment. So I've got my information corrected, and I apologize. Let's go to the phones. We've got a caller from Hampstead. Paul, welcome to Midday with Dr. Green and Dr. Mooney.
Hi, thanks so much for the conversation. I appreciate it. So I have a question because you did bring up the 1918 flu pandemic, which obviously was mediated by H1N1. And then you also brought up polio. And so my question is, at what point does policy, public policy, school entry requirements, things along those lines, have an impact on something like a pandemic? So when it comes to the flu vaccine, we don't have public policy set that says you can or can't go into an establishment based on whether or not you got a flu vaccine. But we do have school entry requirements for all of our kids to go to school by virtue of the inactivated polio vaccine that they must get before they go to school, which of course helps significantly reduce, in fact, eradicate polio in many respects. So if we take that paradigm and we apply it to the coronavirus outbreak that we have and the pandemic that we have now, how does policy influence what could happen as it relates to reduction of circulating virus and ultimately getting us out of the pandemic?
All right. Thanks for that question, Paul. And Dr. Mooney, what do you think? I mean, we do have some colleges and universities requiring their students to be vaccinated before returning in the fall. Where do you think we're headed in terms of policy about vaccinations?
Well, great question, Paul. It's a complicated answer because, you know, one of the reasons why school regulations for immunizations and vaccines came into place in the first place was partly because public health officials realized there were segments of the population who they called, in quotation marks, hard to reach. You know, however much persuasion and attempts to sell vaccines and immunizations, they were choosing not to have their children vaccinated. So school regulations came in as a way of reaching those populations and as a way of focusing on those. I think COVID-19 is sort of interesting because, you know, again, historically, a lot of immunizations have been focused and directed at the youngest members of our population, people who don't have acquired immunity, people who have been targeted by the sort of Dickensian kinds of killers that we recognize from the past, the smallpoxes, the diphtherias, the whooping coughs and the measles. And so COVID's different because it's almost switched the lifespan issue around where we're vaccinating older people first, you know, because they've proven to be more vulnerable in this pandemic. And we yet don't know to what extent the vaccines are safe for children. So I think at the moment, that's where we're at with the border between science and policy, is working out at what point will it be safe to vaccinate children? And then to what extent can we expect parents and guardians to allow their children to be vaccinated? And that's always been a question around government interference, state interference with the right to bring up our children the way we want to bring them up, and you know, the sort of restrictions on our individuality and autonomy to decide what we want to do.
Sure. In 2006, the Baltimore Sun published a series of articles about the 1918 flu, and full disclosure, they were written by my wife, Linnell Smith, who's no longer a reporter for the Sun, but was at the time in 2006. And she made a couple of points. One is, Dr. Green, I'd like you to comment about this, that in 1918, one of the reasons that the havoc was so severe that was caused by that pandemic was that the younger people, the hardiest people, along with the usual victims of, you know, infants and elderly people, but a good deal of young people were stricken and killed by the virus. So society had a difficult time functioning. And scholars, as they've, you know, looked back at that, have said that people planning for current pandemics, like the one we're in, should pay more attention to the emotional as well as physical needs of people to deal with the breakdown in society. And then, of course, we've got the racial dimension to this, the disparities in healthcare that people of color experience that other people do not, really laid bare during this epidemic or this pandemic. Dr. Green, what do you think? I mean, have we done a decent job recognizing these disparities, recognizing, the lessons from the past, i.e. 1918?
So that's a wonderful and complex question, Tom. You know, I think that there are many ways in which our policies for responding to COVID-19 have been based in substantial ways on the experience of 1918, 1919, partly because the entire social distancing rubric put into play drew heavily on studies by some other medical historians using data from that epidemic in North America across 53 American cities, in which the implementation and timing of different social distancing paradigms could be measured against their efficacy. And that became somewhat of the evidence base for the measures we brought to bear. I think there's problems here of continuity and change, and that we may have assumed too many similarities with that pandemic. You know, COVID is a much different, operates on a different time frame, a different level of asymptomaticity. And so some of the promises made early on about what the time course of the pandemic might look like, which were, as we now know, woefully inadequate, may have been based on that false homology. But you ask an even more important question here, which is really about the differential valuation of human lives and the way that we establish responsibility and deservingness to the perceived victims of epidemic disease, and the way that mediates our social response. And that's incredibly powerful, both in terms of an understanding of the sorts of, the valuation of those struck down in the prime of life versus those affected towards the end of their lives, was factored very heavily into some of the more bitter and cynical dimensions of COVID policy wrangling that we saw over the last year, in which many partisans were announcing, well, why should we be intervening on something that only affects older people who are towards the ends of their productive lives already? And again, this differential valuation of whose lives are worth saving. But this, you ask this question about how this intersects with this profound and important conversation we've been having the last year, really about the dual pandemic, especially after the murder of George Floyd last year, in which we've understood that the disparities in morbidity and mortality of COVID-19 in the American population, especially with respect to questions of race and ethnicity, which became apparent really only in April of last year when we started, when after requests from activists demanding the data be divided along race and ethnicity, those disparities became so painfully clear. And there's a dual pandemic here, right, of COVID-19 and structural racism on the other hand. And one of the things that's been, I think, so powerful about looking at the response and what we might call the racial scripting of the response to this pandemic is that although early on we saw once again, claims that perhaps there are biological differences, genetic differences that account for this, I think in the context of the public conversation we've been having over COVID, a lot of those were shut down. And from the very beginning of the reporting of these results in April, the importance of understanding the structural basis whereby comorbidity and challenges of access to health and differential exposure of Black and Latino and Latino and Latinx people in forms of work and jobs in which there would be greater risk and greater exposure and less ability to insulate helped to account for those disparities and needed to be responded to on a structural and a societal basis to provide an equitable response. So I think that in that sense, COVID-19, unlike many prior pandemics, which have historically oftentimes been used as ways of justifying racist policies, the COVID-19 pandemic has become a substantial place in which to question and challenge the basis of structural racism within American society. But I think that conversation is always on the verge of collapse. I think especially when we get into a conversation about what is called vaccine hesitancy, I think we see some of the seeds of a way of getting back towards blaming Black and Latino populations for their poor health again, rather than understanding the structural basis that produces that.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you made that point about the structural racism and what we've learned in the both on the positive side and negative side through the pandemic. Let's go back to the phones in our last few minutes here to Ian, who's on the line from Baltimore. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. My name is Ian. I'm actually a medicine resident across Charles Street at the University of Maryland. And my question is, can we learn from prior pandemics on how this will affect the way we train and sort of develop practitioners? So do you think there will be lingering effects sort of as we go forward for people like myself.
Thanks for that question, Ian. Dr. Mooney, what do you think?
Well, I will just say quickly, I mean, and Jeremy's a clinician, so maybe he can speak to this more directly, but one of the things historically was that when infectious diseases were more common, there were networks of infectious disease hospitals. They were called isolation hospitals, where people who were suffering from smallpox, scarlet fever, diphtheria, typhoid, and so on would be sent, and they would provide they would provide opportunities for medical education. And I think one of the issues going forward will be how to integrate that kind of education into the medical curriculum. And because one of the things that happened when infectious diseases declined was doctors said, well, we don't see these very often anymore. How are we supposed to diagnose them? What can we possibly do? What can we possibly do to understand them better? But I think it's going to be a challenge, particularly a challenge for, how do you educate for a disease that nobody knows exists yet, is a real problem, a real issue. So, that would be my first response to that.
Yeah, and Dr. Green, we just have a few seconds left. Let me have you give the last word on that and answer to Ian's question.
Sure, and I'm going to lean here on my colleague Keith Whalew, a historian at Princeton, who's been writing about the racial scripting of pandemics. Like, if we look at tuberculosis from the 1880s to the 1910s, there are folks here in Baltimore that produced maps of tuberculosis in which the most important differentiating feature on that maps was whether the patients were black or white, and showed clusterings of black neighborhoods in which tuberculosis was considered to be rampant as reasons for raising those neighborhoods and displacing African-American populations here in Baltimore. And at the same time, there's others like W.E.B. Du Bois, who in Philadelphia writes an analysis of how tuberculosis disparities are playing out between black and white populations in Philadelphia, suggesting that really the basis of this difference is not any inherent difference between black and white bodies, but this accumulated force of structural racism, the historical basis, the concentration and segregation of the city, the marginalization in economic forms. And I point this out to say that even in past epidemics, even though this thing that occurred more than a century ago might seem remote to us, there's still a choice for someone training in medicine to figure out how they interpret social disparities that are made visible by epidemic disease. Does one double down and contribute to a racist structure, or does one find the basis of understanding the social forms that produce structural racism and work against this? And looking for both that racist discourse, but also anti-racist counter discourse, is actually present even back to the 1793 yellow fever epidemic in Philadelphia. We can find both choices throughout history. And so I think keeping that in mind as we look at what might seem inevitable or the only way of talking about something today, to realize we should always be looking for counter discourse.
Yeah, well, the choice is there. As you say, that's an excellent point. Dr. Jeremy Green and Dr. Graham Mooney, they are medical historians at Johns Hopkins Medicine. Doctors, thank you very, very much for your insight and perspective. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Tom.
Coming up, remembering the journalist and former senior news analyst here at WIPR, Fraser Smith. You are welcome to share your memories of Fraser, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWIPR. A former and current WIPR news director, Suni Khalid and Joel McCord, will join me to share their reflections after a quick break. Stay with us.
You're listening to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.